Guys, welcome to another episode of Natural Fertility with Dr. Jane. I, of course, I'm Dr. Jane, but today I'm joined by with Amy Ropp. You are a fertility expert that I have been following for a while, so I'm super stoked to have you on the podcast to share your wisdom with my audience.
Oh, thank you, Jane. Thank you so much for having me. I love doing this, so thank you.
Yeah. How long have you been doing this for?
I've been in clinical practice for 21 years as an acupuncturist and herbalist, and I started writing books on women's health. And my first book came out in 2010. Okay. And so I've been in this space of, I think, you know, really preaching from the rooftops, if you will, about the power we have over our health and our fertility for, you know, over gosh, it's crazy, like 15, 16 years at this point.
Yeah, one of the questions I ask my veterans, if you will, is like, what are you seeing in practice now that you didn't see 10 years ago or, you know, even when you first started?
How young fertility challenges are impacting now, the male factor piece, you know, it seems like it's two things. It's like the dichotomy is really interesting. And this just came to me for the first time. One, that my fertility clients, like my older fertility clients, keep getting older, right? So like now it used to be like 44, 45. Then it was like 46, 47 with their own eggs. Now we're at like 48. I have a handful of 48-year-olds doing it with their own eggs. So that's interesting that like we are, if you will, hacking the biology piece and extending fertility. And I think really, you know, now we can put a label on it, like really understanding how to maximize fertility in perimenopause. But the other side of the equation is the, like I had a call this morning with, she's 29 years old. She's on her fourth failed IVF. They have to do IVF for male factor reasons, but why is she not getting pregnant? And we've already dug into it. There's an immunological factor going on that no one's looked at because A, I think she's so young and B, they're just kind of like, whatever, you have time. But so women are getting younger and the bigger role of male factor. You know, I think that's obviously now we're seeing it 50% of all cases. We've been talking about endometriosis for a really long time. Like back when I first started, you know, doing this work, it used to be, we would say 40% of unexplained fertility challenges were endometriosis. Now that number is up to 50%. I think it's, and you probably think, I think it's more like 70%, but from what I see clinically and when we really dig in, and then we're seeing a lot of, you know, we were seeing it a decade ago, but the autoimmune role in fertility challenges as well is just, I think the, what is it, 75% increase of autoimmunity in women in their 30s and into their 40s.
Yeah.
And, it's, you know, it's impacting women more than men. So, and that's all impacting fertility.
Yeah. It's, what do you say to, well, we just have better diagnostics now, so we're diagnosing more versus it is actually just becoming more prevalent?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think it's the same thing with children's and learning disabilities and the spectrum disorders, you know, it's the same thing.
Do you think though it is increasing?
I think it's impacting people younger than it used to. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. You know, our genetic predispositions have always been there, right? And I think the lifestyle now is amplifying the expression at a younger age. Yep. But perhaps also, right, if like, you know, when I wrote Body Belief, which is my book really on autoimmunity, and I really took that dive after writing Yes, You Can Get Pregnant, because you see the correlation so much in the data, like even, you know, I wrote that book 12 years ago, it was very clear in the data that unexplained fertility challenges had an autoimmune link or an inflammatory link at minimum. And when you dig into the autoimmune research, you see it's like, well, since the 80s, we've introduced over 100,000 chemicals into our environment. And then ever since then, it's just like gangbusters. You know, it's just gangbusters. All this glyphosate conversation. I love that we're having a public conversation about glyphosate right now. I mean, we've known about glyphosate, what?
over a decade. Since we started practicing, for sure.
Yeah. So I do. I think information and awareness are there more now than ever, thanks to, you know, Instagram and TikTok and all these, you know, I just had a conversation with one of the influencers this morning, and I feel emotional saying this. I said to her in all sincerity, I was like, thank you so much for sharing your story, because you are, I said to her, I literally said this. I said, you are literally making babies every time you share a story, because you're sharing the classic story, unexplained fertility challenges, IVF was the only answer. No, she has endometriosis and she has endometritis in her uterus.
Is it Ellie?
Yeah, it's Ellie.
I have been following her and I was like, yes.
I know. I like literally cried. Like I sent her a voice memo this morning because I was just like, I'm not working with her, like full disclosure or anything like that. Like obviously like her story is her story to share. I reached out to her because same thing. I've been following her and I was like, thank you. Like you're... What you're doing for the community, like I know you know because you're part of the community, but you actually have no idea because she's validating. And also for us practitioners, it's like how long have we been made to feel like we're making crap up? You know what I mean? Or that we're digging deeper, looking for problems when there are none to look for. You know, like, when you look deeper, you're just going to find more problems. It's like, well, that's the point. Let's figure this out. This is not her age. You know, you can't start blaming a 29-year-old and tell her it's her egg quality. You can't do that. It goes against every dogma that they've created too. So anyway, don't get me started. I do think diagnostics have gotten better. I do think the environment and lifestyle and all the things, right? I just revised, yes, you can get pregnant. I think one of the biggest reflections I've had from when I wrote that book, it came out in 2014, so I wrote it in 2013. I just revised it last year, right? So about 12 years apart, the screen time, the blue light, the circadian rhythm impacts are serious. Like it also to me blows my mind that 12 years ago we weren't doing all this. I'm on 7 Zooms a day. I mean, how about you? You know what I mean? Like easily. And then I'm on my freaking Instagram and TikTok. And I say freaking because it does. Sometimes it feels like I'm beholden to it because it's also part of my job. But
totally.
Oh, my goodness gracious. And what that's doing, we know it's impacting melatonin. We know it's impacting our neurotransmitters. We know it's impacting our hormones. Like, so all of that, it's like, is it just amplifying the expression of the, you know, dis-ease or disharmony sooner? Or are we, are we just a more inflamed, immunologically compromised, you know?
Yeah, I'll often say, like, I just feel zapped by the end of the day when I've had a lot, because I literally feel zapped by the EMFs. And then it's like, I just need to go outside and it'll be like minus 30 here. And I'm like, I don't care. I just need to get outside.
Yeah.
Like one of my patients, I laugh because he's like, I'm just having a hard time sleep. What's the biohack? Like, he's really into biohacking. And I just got into, like, how many hours are you working? And it's like, oh, I'm on my laptop until 11.
Yeah,
cool.
No,
can you just, like, get off the laptop at 8? And then he sends me a screenshot of his Aura ring. He's like, that's the best sleep I've had in years.
Well, that's it.
It doesn't have to be that complicated.
It doesn't have to be that complicated.
Biohack.
And
you
that's
can just
it.
Turn off your laptop.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. Like, and I was saying that to you before we started recording, like, what was also pretty fascinating or awesome to witness when revising Yes, You Can Get Pregnant is, like, I have a whole chapter in that book, again, 13 years ago, where I talked about, like, the basics of fertility is getting back in touch with nature, right? And so that's cool. Now they have terms. Now we're saying circadian rhythm. Now we're saying nervous system. Now we're saying, you know what I mean? We're biohacking, like HRV. Like, we have all these terms for it now. Same stuff, though, guys. Get to bed by 10 or 11. Limit your screen time. But now cool, too, of like, you know, I've changed out all the light bulbs in the house. We're amber lights across the board. We have, you know, circadian lighting, if you will. Like, now there's a term for that. You know, I'm using my Pulsetto device. I freaking love it. My vagus nerve stimulator, like, love it. You know, so we're getting ahead of it on certain levels. But then it's also lifestyle. It's just gotten, like, COVID was a huge blessing for many of us and lifestyle shifted. But now I think we've all gone so far digital. You know, some people, right? I'm the same with some of my clients. They don't even get outside during the day.
Yeah.
They don't
ever
even go outside.
You can get groceries delivered to your house.
I'm guilty of it. I can do it. There are days where I don't leave the house. I mean, I get outside with the dog. I try to get outside for my morning sunlight. Yeah. If not, I'm at least sitting in a well-lit room with a window open, even if it is 0 degrees out, you know, where I'm just trying to get that natural light. But it's, the lifestyle is really catching up to us. And it's absolutely showing itself in fertility challenges.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have 25-year-olds who've been struggling to conceive for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's nuts. And they're pushed into IVF, of course. And then, you know, you see the clients on the other side who've been trying to conceive for 14 years and now it's your age. But it's like, but it wasn't your age 14 no, years
I,
ago.
I mean, all the time. Well, I'm like, but let's go back 8 years when she first came to you at 35. Come on now, people. I mean, I think also that too, I think another thing that's changed is we really understand this fertile cliff now in a different way. It's not a cliff. It's a gradual decline, you know, and it's a slope. It's a slope. It's not a cliff. I want that out there more and more. There's some really great studies. The one I always quote is, you know, he looked at 20,000 eggs. These are women undergoing IVF, so not embryos, and saw a slope-like decline in egg quality. But even women in their, you know, I think a study went up to 44. Even women in that 43, 44 bracket, still about 35 to 40% of their eggs were chromosomally normal. And so that's not what's being told out there to women at all. We need to scream that from the rooftops louder, you know, and really yeah. It's like, it's not like, I know the popular book, I think it says it starts with the egg. It is not just the egg. Like and even when that book came out, I appreciate the content, of course. The title is, it triggers me. There's a new one out too, another one about the egg. And it's like, oh, it's so much pressure on women because it is not just about the egg and it is not just about your age. And the people out there spreading that information are doing a great disservice and putting a lot more pressure and stress on women. You know, we have to think about sperm. We have to think about the uterus. We have to think about the immune system. If we're not thinking about all four of those things, we are so missing the boat.
Yeah. And they're all intertwined. You know, because if you have the immune system that's dysregulated, there's no way that the egg is going to be any quality. And then if I look at, you know, I work with couples, I've never seen a female that has a dysregulated immune system and the guy that's all fine. He says he's all fine, but he's actually holding on to so many infections. It's like, oh, I just have this flaky scalp, or I just have this itching over here. Or I just get this random rash, and they just don't think anything of it. And then here she is, you know, full-blown autoimmune disease, because obviously there's more of a genetic predisposition. And I think it's just all connected and intertwined. Yeah. There's a couple pieces that I want to talk to you that I think are very intriguing. So the autoimmune component, first, maybe let's break that down a little bit, because I still think that most people don't really understand that pregnancy and fertilization is an immune process and why autoimmune disease, and how many women are walking around with autoimmune disease and they don't know it. And then I want to talk about the IVF, the 48, the PRP, all of those, because I know that there's a lot of, I love those stories, because it's like when a 35-year-old is told that she's too old, and you're like,
and then you're like, well, you have 13 years ahead of you.
Yeah. That just got pregnant naturally. You're not too old. Let's figure this out.
And it's so hard. I'm always careful with that conversation. I mean, I know you are too, of like, your timeline is your timeline, and we respect that. And we want to honor that as much as we can. But it's also, I think, what's the word I want to use? Like, plausible, or like gentle hope to also remind you that women much older than you are doing this. And so you do have a window, even though you're being told you don't, you know? I agree. So autoimmunity, I mean, I think the stats are, it impacts 75% more than men. Yeah. And it really comes on in women in their 30s, is it? And so when it comes to pregnancy, a big thing that, like you said, no one realizes is there's an immune challenge when the body is designed to fight off anything foreign, right? So a mosquito bite to an infection, right? We fight our, you know, our killer cells, our TNF-alphas, all those things just go in and take care of it. Pregnancy is very curious, because for some reason we accept an embryo that's half not us. And to this date, no one really understands that from an implantation immune perspective. There's low level understanding, but it's still kind of a very curious thing. Like, oh, that's so interesting that we accept.
But I do think that's probably why women are more predisposed to autoimmune conditions, because they need to have this kind of flexibility where they need to accept a foreign DNA. You know, and then now,
that itself can be a challenge. They might not be able to accept it, right? They might have these HLAs. That's a big one, the human leukocyte antigens. And we just reject. We either don't implant or we have continuous miscarriages. The other side of that is that pregnancy itself can trigger an autoimmune condition because of this, up and down, this kind of roller coaster of an immune system, or just the adaptability that is required of the female body to accept the embryo. And so even if you never carried that pregnancy to term, if you had a miscarriage, it can then trigger an autoimmune response. We also see Hashimoto's a lot of women that'll come on postpartum. So then they're dealing with secondary fertility challenges. And so all autoimmunity is, it's not like, I know many people like to say a hyper immune system. And you probably are similar. It's just dysregulated. It basically is confused. I would like to explain it as like the template has been jostled. And so now what was once considered normal is now like, I'm not so sure. And so it can attack its own organs. Like, we know there's ovarian antibodies, right? There's obviously thyroid antibodies. There's, all sorts of antibodies that the body can create and trigger this immune response. And then any triggered immune response will relate in an extended immune response to anything else. So, if you're the girl that gets a bug bite and then it breaks into these huge hives or these rashes, like, to me, that's a huge clue from a fertility perspective. I'm thinking right away there's an immune system, and right away you're not welcoming of anything foreign. So including that embryo and that sperm, right? You're Ixnay on the sperm antibodies too. I know I forgot an antibody before when I was talking about antibodies. So autoimmunity, I think I would like to venture to say is probably, playing a role, I'd say at least 70% of the cases, right? But then also inflammation can trigger autoimmunity as well. And I think all of our cases are dealing with some level of inflammation. It's almost like it's not the level of inflammation. It's your constitution and how much your body feels it can get away with is basically it. And whether or not it's shunting you into like preservation mode, fight or flight mode, or you can still stay in this relax and reproduce mode. And that's our key, right? That's what we're always trying to figure out. Like, and everybody's different, but how do we get her body and his into this relax, reproduce state so that it can be accepting that the immune system is more resilient and adaptable and allows the pregnancy to thrive. And so some of these things are harder to detect and find. Like, I wish there was like a blanket blood test we can do. We'll look at things like inflammatory markers or ANA, and sometimes we're running like ovarian antibodies and anti-sperm antibodies. Obviously we're always ruling out Hashimoto's in our cases, things like celiac or even non-celiac gluten intolerance. I think that's gotten a big name too, since the first version of Yes, You Can Get Pregnant to this one. That's got a whole big section in the book now, so but it's also like the way I was trained from an Eastern medicine perspective is I'm really good at looking at all this, the symptom picture, the holistic picture of all the pieces, and trying and kind of seeing the body's yep. in this fight or flight mode. I mean, I think similar to you. And then of course we can use the labs and functional testing to really help understand, like, a lot of times, right, there are these low-lying infections that has triggered something, right? It could be mold. It could be,
toxic load. I don't know if you test toxic load, but I'll test it sometimes and I'm like, what is happening in your body? Like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
this is horrifying. Just looking at these results.
it's scary. But also though, what I think is interesting, because like I'm newer to the functional medicine side of things. Like, I kind of resisted it for a while, if I'm totally honest. Mm-hmm. Now I have a practitioner on my team. I shouldn't say resist, but like for me in my brain, it was like, I have all the Western medicine stuff down and all the Eastern medicine. If I throw in something else, it's like, is it going to be jumbled? But what I do find fascinating when we get those results is three different women could have the same level of toxic load, the same level of an H. pylori infection, the same level of high zonulin, totally different presentations. One is just going about her day, hair, skin, nails, perfect, bowel movements, perfect, sleep, perfect, egg quality's looking, do you know what I mean? And then, so it's, to me, till it's like a step back. And my mentor, who's a master herbalist that I've studied with for years, always says, she uses Lyme disease as the example. She's like, the ticks aren't getting more aggressive. The Lyme isn't getting more aggressive. It's the constitution of the person who gets bit by the tick. So it's the same thing of like, it's still about this inherent constitution. And yes. That's what we do, right? We're working on that kind of that template, that base level to boost them so that then their body can say, okay, I can put this over here. I can reprioritize this. Like, brain and ovaries can start communicating again, right? And for everyone, for one girl that's getting her to an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10, another it's getting her to a 2. It varies. So we're really looking at symptomology and function in the body to determine you know, how impacted they are by these things.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you brought that up. I do think the genetics plays a role, not to excuse someone's behavior or whatever, no. But there are people who, if they have an extra 5 to 10 pounds on mm-hmm. them, they will have such an inflammatory cascade in their That's body right. from that extra 5 to 10 pounds. And then there's people who will carry 20 or 30 and they won't have that same level of inflammatory cascade. Now, you know, we want to have an optimal healthy weight for pregnancy for both males and females, but it's how that person is carrying the weight, where they're carrying it is going to be, there's so many more pieces to it than that.
Oh,
and
gosh,
with
yes.
functional testing, the eye-opening thing for me is always the presentation can be so different yeah. for each person, how they experience leaky gut. Like, I've seen people have leaky gut and be like, I have normal bowel movements, zero mm-hmm. issues, but they'll have a rash on their body, you know? That's and right. it's like, okay, so you're showing it like this versus the other person has very typical IBS symptoms, running to the bathroom, lots of urgency, or constipation, like, you know.
Right.
So I do find them insightful, but you always have to look at the person sitting in front of you and treat the person.
Yeah, you know? And you have to take the whole picture. I mean, I'm constantly saying that to my team because I feel like we're always, you know, at the core, I always want to hold on to like our Eastern medicine philosophies and like yes. not get lost. Yes. And so it's like, well, but her TSH is this and her free T3 is this. I'm like, but if she's not symptomatic, we're going to, of course, we're still going to support the root, but like, but some girls are symptomatic of hyperthyroidism at 0.8 on their TSH and others can be 0.2 and they're perfectly fine, you know? So I agree. It's like, it's, and maybe that's why on the Western side of things, they can get a little uppity about all of the details we are looking at because it's not black and white. Hashimoto's girl with a couple hundred level of antibodies doesn't mean full-blown, you know, inflammation or inability to get pregnant, whereas someone else could have, you know, a load of 60 to 70 and it's impacting everything. So the holistic picture is so important. And then also kind of seeing the cycles. I think all of it has like cyclical flares and really understanding that and the triggers and getting them to this, you know, place. It's like a homeostasis. That's what we're really trying to work on, is returning the body to homeostasis. And then of course, you know, I am a detective and I want to look at everything. So I think every woman before she starts trying to conceive should have her uterus looked at and have the microbiome tested. I mean, it'd be the first thing I would do personally. First
totally.
Thing.
Yeah.
I'd probably, you know, I would love everybody getting that 3D sono that's out there now. Let's rule out endometriosis. Let's make sure there's no adenomyosis. Let's do a microbiome test. Let's get a hysteroscopy. Then send them to IVF if we don't have, you know what I mean? Like, what is this? I mean, the yeah. IVF process, you need to have 2 to 3 miscarriages before they're going to do any deeper introspection. And some doctors won't still.
Yeah.
Because it's just a recommendation.
Yeah. How do you deal with, you know, being an alternative practitioner? And I'm sure you have some women who are getting pregnant through IVF or potentially, you know, right? Like using donor eggs or donor sperm.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with a conventional system?
I always meet my girls where they're at is what I would say first. Like, so if someone's really committed maybe is the wrong word, believes that IVF is their only option and that they have to get a genetically normal embryo to transfer, I'll meet them there 100%. You know, if someone is done yep. trying with their own eggs or their partner's sperm, or absolutely, you want to do donor? Totally. I just had a girl put a 45-year-old untested embryo into a surrogate that was strongly discouraged by everyone, of course. Surrogate's 20 weeks pregnant with a healthy baby girl. The embryo was not working inside of her because she had an HLA issue that no one wanted to rule out. Now she's pregnant with a donor embryo. The whole thing's fascinating. But I'm flexible is what I would say. I always believe there's a possibility, the, if you will, old fashioned way, you know, when we maximize sperm health and uterine health and egg health and immunological health. And a lot of our girls get pregnant along the way to IVF or trying things, or it takes a while to kind of convince them. Maybe we stop testing embryos. Maybe we freeze at day 3. I'm always encouraging second or third opinions with different doctors. I always work integratively. You know, I do have women that come to me and they don't want to meet with a single doctor and they don't want to do any testing Okay. But I'm probably the one who's also trying to convince them at minimum to do like the uterine microbiome testing or, things like that. So we can at least understand what we're working with, so as to not waste time and to be as efficient as possible. So yeah, I mean, I'm not against IVF by any means. I think it's a beautiful technology. I think, and it's afforded a lot of people beautiful families. But I also think everyone has to remember it hasn't been around that long. PGT-A testing is new to the game. There's a lot of question of it's as accurate as we once thought it was. I was around long before AMH existed, long before PGT-A existed. We were transferring day two, day three, highly fragmented embryos, and they were making babies. You know what I mean? So, like, I have a hard time subscribing to that extent of it. But again, if that's what is like in the heart of my client and her partner, if she's partnered, I'm down with it. And then I just try to, I always am just trying to lead with, okay, this is what the data is showing us. This is what you can do. These are the options. I'm looking at protocols always because I think most IVF protocols are way too gangbusters. Most women get much better results with half the medications. So is it their fault? Like I, when we're reassessing an IVF that didn't work, I'm never blaming her. I'm, A, but and B, probably not him, but he probably hasn't been as checked thoroughly as he should be. So we're doing a DNA frag or we're thinking about sperm health. I always say, even if it looks good on paper, it could be better. So we're going to work on his health too. And then have we looked at the uterus? What is the protocol? Can we adjust that? Why are we pushing to day five? Looking at when did they die off? When did they stop, not growing? What does that tell us? There's so much information we can gather from that and then, tweak and go back to it if that's what we want.
Work with the body, right? Do you think that the IVF clinics are pushing the PGT testing because that's what allows them to have the highest results because they're not looking at uterine health, they're not looking at like ovarian health, sperm health,
Sure.
immune health. So then they're like, this, if we test and they're genetically normal, then that's quote unquote guaranteed to work as opposed to, you were saying before PGT
Yeah,
testing
it
was
takes
around.
out some of the guessing. I think it removes another variable, but we have to remember too that I believe the current data shows that PGT-A testing is about 70% accurate. So there's a good level of inaccuracy. Typically, euploids are always euploids, but aneuploids are not always aneuploids. And so you can retest. You could I have my girls meet with a geneticist, Megan Doyle. She's brilliant. I send everyone to her. She goes through their reports. She'll tell you which embryos could make healthy children and how and why, which ones to discard, which ones to keep. We have a hard rule. We don't throw out any embryos. Any girls that are working with me, no embryos. I was also kind of like high level taught. If there's pluses, meaning extra chromosomes, they're not probably going to make healthy children, but the minuses should. Mosaics, we always keep. But also, I don't know. I don't totally trust the testing. So if you have embryos, keep them. And we could, if we get to that point, we transfer them. Another doctor has recently told me that if an embryo implants, there's a 40% chance we take home a healthy baby, regardless of what the genetic testing told us. So I think to all that, there's just so much we don't know. I think IVF doctors, it's how they're trained. I have no qualm with them, to be honest. They're thinking about how many variables can I solve for so that I can get you there as quickly as possible. Where I do have qualms is they're not keen on extensive testing. There's just straight up some docs who will not do a hysteroscopy, who do not believe the uterine microbiome has an impact. And I'm like, I'm sorry, have you read it? Like what? Or who think if there's endometriosis, IVF is the solution. Again, have you read the data? Because it's clear women with IVF have poorer women with endo have poorer IVF outcomes. And they, once IV endo is treated, they have better outcomes. So that's where I get upset because it's, but the other thing that we know is it can take a decade for clinical research to actually hit the clinics, or data to hit the clinics. And so
Yeah. At least, if not longer. And then by the time, with the speed that everything is coming out now with AI, it's like that's going to be outdated in 5 years. So then by the time you catch up to the 10 years, that's already outdated. And
And
then,
some of these girls, if you're 47, you've missed your window.
you don't have
You
5 years.
don't have it. And that pisses me off. But But yeah, I mean, I think IVF is changing rapidly too. However, I do think it's in the best interest of many to avoid the large clinics who are like VC funded, and sure. You're better off with the privately funded clinics where doctors can kind of do their own things because they're funding it themselves or they're personal friends with whoever it is.
Yeah, my favorite is when they put all the women on the birth control so then they can time their cycle and then just... And like one of my clients, I remember, she's like, they told me to take DHEA, but I have high DHEA. Should I be not?
And I'm like, test don't guess. DHEA test don't guess. I mean, it starts with the egg. Like she had to backtrack that in her book, but I mean, that was it. 75 milligrams of DHEA for every woman who reads this book. I'm like, oh, well, you just did a shitload of damage to those eggs. Thank you very much. Yeah. We test, we don't guess.
I take obviously I want to try things on my own, and 5 milligrams of DHEA. Oh, and for 3 days I was like, oh, I can't. Amazing. Like I was like, what? And I had low DHEA when I took it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, let me try this. Let me see how it works. And it was like, what? Like I broke up the 5 and I would just sprinkle under my tongue and that's it. And that was perfect. And I felt amazing. And it helped me get out of this kind of adrenal funk, if you will. But 75 milligrams and she's just growing hairs on her chin. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. And also like we know DHEA and testosterone are super important in helping with egg quality. But too much is going to, like in Chinese medicine, we would say they're too stimulating. They're going to fry the eggs, you know? And so that's problematic. And so, you know, I've gotten into it with doctors about that. And I'm very firm. I'm like, listen, you can be mad at me all you want for saying what I want, but if you're not running a simple blood test on your patient, then shame on you. Shame on you. You should test, don't guess. You test her FSH, you know, and her LH and her, you know, all her things every freaking chance you get. And you remind her of those numbers all the time. Test the other things. They're important. Test her vitamin D. Test her thyroid. Test her DHEA.
Test her blood sugar.
Yeah. Oh my God. The blood sugar thing. Forget about it. I mean, the GLP-1s are, it's amazing what we're seeing as a side effect of managing insulin resistance. And I'm not saying everyone should rush to be on a GLP-1, but I'm pointing out that insulin resistance plays a massive role. So again, kind of back to what I was saying of like the things that changed in the first version of Yes, You Can Get Pregnant until now. I always talked about blood sugar stability. I always talked about not skipping meals. I always talked about moving after meals. Now we have a term for it, right? You know, increasing insulin sensitivity or decreasing insulin resistance. But we're also understanding now insulin resistance plays a massive role in mitochondrial function. Mitochondrial function plays a massive role in egg and sperm quality and in implantation. So it's, you know, let's look at all these things instead of just, oh, she's not PCOS. She doesn't have insulin resistance. Like, what is that? What is that? Remember, we used to be like lean type, thick type. That's what they would call it. Now they're changing the name of PCOS altogether, which I also think is great. But like these metabolic disorders play a massive role in hormonal challenges, and it's never looked at.
Yep. I had a couple, 5 rounds of failed IVF, and she literally did not have like a basic blood sugar panel or even like a full thyroid panel. So just the TSH. And they're like, we just want answers. And I just laughed, like, and I left with them. And I was like, since when are you coming to a holistic practitioner to get lab testing? Like, when did that switch happen? I remember when I first started practicing, which was 11 years ago, I would be like, you go to your doctor, you get the labs, and then I'll like help review it from an optimal standpoint. And then over time, I was just like, I'm going to run because the doctors are not running the labs anymore. They used to. And then it was less markers and then less markers and then less markers and then just turning people down and being like, you only need blood work every couple of years. What are you talking about? And it's like, okay, I'm going to start running these tests. So there's been a big switch, and I've kind of been shocked of like, if you're in a medical professional, like, doesn't it make sense to do testing so then you know what the treatment is? And it's like, no, we just treat anyways. And that's how you know there's some corruption going on.
Yeah. I think even Hashimoto's is a good example where it's like, well, it doesn't matter because your TSH is doing fine. So we wouldn't do anything with an autoimmunity, but like from our side, very different.
There's lots we can do.
You know? And I also think that's the benefit. Like I hosted a retreat. It was in May or sometime in 2025. And one of the girls at the retreat was like brand new to me. I'd never, some of the girls that came, I'd been coaching with or seen in the clinic or something. And this girl I never met before, you know, and we do this kind of round table and we go around and share. And she's got these like raging periods, you know, where she's like hemorrhaging. And then, and like every third period, she's in like so much pain. She can't like leave the house. They've done multiple failed IUIs, you know, being, she's 40, she was 39 at the time, you know, of course being told donor eggs and IVF were her only option. And I was like, well, what did a hysteroscopy show? Or what is like a transvaginal, you know? She was like, I was like, do you have any reports? You know? So anyway, like we continue our care together. She decides to start working with me after the retreat. And she's working with an IVF clinic who I like, and I had actually recommended her to go to, and they want to just push to IVF. And I said to the doctor who I have a relationship with, I said to her, I was like, you know, first things first, I want a hysteroscopy on her. I want to understand what's going on with her uterus. And she was like, well, Amy, we wouldn't do that till transfer. I was like, no, we have to understand what's going on. Sure enough, she wakes up. They only do a diagnostic. They don't do the operative because they don't do that in the clinic. This clinic in particular, other clinics do. She wakes up and they were like, oh, yeah, you have this massive fibroid blocking the opening to your uterus. And then we count countless other fibroids. And there's a cyst on your ovary. And I was like, who was the professional that was doing these IUIs on her and didn't either A, point this out. We got reports because there was a question of like, were they there? No, they were there. No one ever pointed them out to her. Yeah. Then
I was just doing my job. I was just putting
That's what we say to her. Her mother sent me this beautiful message. She's not pregnant yet, but she will be soon. She wound up having endometriosis. She had her fibroids removed. She had endometritis. You know, I mean, the gamut. She had it all. No one was willing to diagnose any of it. And so I joke and I say, you had to go to a retreat run by an acupuncturist to find out that you needed a freaking like saline sonogram and a hysteroscopy. That blows my mind. I love myself. I love my job. I love what I do. That is not how the system should be run. That doesn't make any sense. So you have to pay out of pocket for all these like extraneous, you know what I mean? Like we're awesome practitioners. I think we move the needle. I'm so proud of the work we're doing. Honestly, like I can get emotional about it. I'm so proud. But to me, it's also like, yeah, the bigger issue is the system. Like, why are we not diagnosing? Why are we not digging deeper and looking? These are basic things that we could help someone navigate and rule out. And one doctor actually said to her, well, like if we take all these fibroids out, I mean, we might as well just take the uterus out. I was like, okay, we...
out.
Not the person we need to be meeting with. There are... And I always say there are amazing surgeons out there that fertility preservation is their first choice. Like that is what they lead with. And that's who we work with. We do not work with the random OBGYN who is thinking that these fibroids.
It's easier to just remove the uterus because I don't want to be in there fiddling with a fibroid.
I can't wait till my phone stops autocorrecting hysteroscopy to hysterectomy. Like I can't wait for hysteroscopy to be the word instead of hysterectomy. It drives me insane, but it always triggers me. It's so funny because I'm like, this is exactly what's wrong with our society. This right here. Hysterectomy versus
just remove the organ. It's fine. Just remove it. And then all your problems will go away.
And then, you know, oh, get a surrogate. I love that one too. And listen, I'm not against surrogate. I love surrogate. I cry every time I meet my girls. I always work with their surrogates too. I always thank them for doing God's work is what I say. You know, they're angels. They truly are.
Yes.
But I appreciate donor eggs and donor sperm, but I like my patients to be able to have all the information possible so they can make the decision that's best for their family and their timeline, not you tell them that this is their only option. I don't think that's fair. It's very disempowering. And especially if you haven't collected all the information.
Mm-mm. Yep. Yeah. Well, you don't know. You don't know what you don't know. Right. Let's talk about the 48-year-olds, the 47-year-olds, what's being done right now, what's possible, how is it possible? And I'd love for you to layer, like, how do you know when it is time to use a donor egg? How do you know when it is time to go to IVF? Because I think that there isn't clear guidelines, you know?
It's hard to gauge. So the women that I've been working with, but it's not for all of them, I have to be honest. But I'm thinking right now, my recent, like, 48-year-olds. One went to donor egg and just had a healthy child. That story's interesting. She still had a good reserve. She did ovarian PRP. We were doing retrievals. We had done a transfer, didn't take. She felt discouraged. And she just kind of had this like wake up one day and she was like, you know what? I think I'm going to go to donor. I won't take the pressure off myself. I always joke I wasn't ready for that, but like I fully supported her readiness. But yep. I share this story because then she went and got a donor embryo or donor egg, partner sperm. She miscarried because no one did the due diligence on why she had had that miscarriage right before when she first started working with me at 47. And turns out she had a clotting factor issue and we'd already done a hysteroscopy, but she had some other factors going on. So she needed an immune protocol to then hold that donor. So I bring that up because I don't believe it was age that was impacting her ability to get and stay pregnant. There was something else going on. No one looked into it, right? She had Hashimoto's. We knew that. But the other cases were spontaneous pregnancies. Well, I've had one 48-year-old made a genetically PGTA-tested embryo, genetically normal embryo, that a surrogate carried to term. She did use donor sperm. I do think about that. I think that the young sperm, healthy mitochondria in the sperm probably played a role in creating that embryo. And then I've had two spontaneous pregnancies in 48-year-old women, more than two, like probably close to a dozen in 47-year-old women. One notable, her AMH was 0.01 when she went for an antral follicle count at a clinic. The doctor said, good luck getting pregnant. You have like one egg left. And we just tweaked our things and you know, it worked out for her. And
that was natural conception.
Natural conception. So I think the things I think about as a clinician, I wonder about like if there was a recent pregnancy and a loss, which losses suck. I've been there. I'm not using the loss as a positive example, but it tells me something. It tells me that egg and sperm are able to meet, egg and sperm are able to implant. What else could be going on? And then especially if there's like, I have another one I'm working with. I mean, she's had a total of 11 chemical pregnancies over the past 5 years. And of course, everybody's blaming her egg quality. No, I got her the right team. And I mean, yes, now she's like 47. But guess what? No, she's got a host of immunological stuff. She also had like uterine infections. I mean, all the things. So her doctor now is like, yeah, let's continue to try naturally. Because clearly, egg and sperm want to do their thing. Clearly, and I was taught, you know, I studied, I don't know if studied is the right word. I would consider him a mentor, Dr. Jeffrey Braverman. He's since passed away, but he was Braverman Reproductive Immunology, and he studied with Alan Beers. But he would always say to me, nature isn't that stupid. It's not going to keep picking a bad egg or bad sperm and miscarrying. Like, sure, maybe in that age group, like the higher 40s, I would expect, you know, I think the stat is if you get pregnant, 50% chance of live birth, right? So 50% chance of miscarriage, 50% chance of live birth. And maybe two miscarriages is egg quality, right? But not three. And so maybe in our younger girls, one out of three, maybe in our older girls, two out of three. So I'm thinking about all that. I'm of course looking at sperm and I present all the data. I say to them, okay, how many months do we want to try like this? Then at what point do we want to consider IUI or IVF, or is that completely off the table? You know, again, it's meeting them where they're at. You know, I have a call on Monday with one of my girls who is in her late 40s. And she, you know, just sent me an email of like, what are our other options? I'm at this point now. And now, mind you, when she first came to me, she had just had a pregnancy and miscarried. So to me, that's, you know, possibility. Some of these other girls, though, that never had that pregnancy that showed me a possibility, then when we dug deeper into uterine health, typically there was an issue and we fixed that, then they got pregnant, which, you know, is also like, okay, they probably could have gotten pregnant 3 years ago, but no one looked. So I don't know. How do you know when it's time? I mean, I always have this vision, and what I do with all my clients is it'll be kind of like whiteboarded out. These are options. Option A, B, C. And I'm going to lay them all out. And you are the decider of your fate, though. When are you ready for this? I'm not going to push you. But then sometimes it is. It's that conversation.
But I will also look at your data and I will tell you if it's realistic or not.
Yeah. And, it's like, you know, that's the thing, though, with me is like, if you have hope, I have hope with you. Like, that's just how I roll.
I mean, I find I usually have more hope than I have 35-year-olds who are like, I don't think I can get pregnant. And it's like, Come on, girl. Yeah, where is it? Where, let me help you find that fire.
Same. Even like the mid 40s, I'm like, girlfriend, we got this. Like, we got this. However, does it take work? Yes. You know what I mean? Is it like,
are you going to be a completely different person? Yes.
Are we going to like really dig deep into investigations? We are. And you're not going to ever regret that, though. That's like, that's kind of what I've learned in like the longevity of my practice is like, I look back on certain cases that didn't get to the other side, and I wouldn't. Maybe I'd say I have regret. I wish I knew then what I know now, and I would have made other recommendations. And so that's the thing for all you guys out there listening of like, I think it's okay for you to seek counsel from multiple different experts out there to try to find and get to the root cause of this. And for some of you, you have more time than others, but like efficiency is really like the name of the game for me. So yeah, I'm always like, hey, you know, I always say like borrow a few cells from somebody else. There's no, you know, that's an emotional leap that people have to take, you know, or surrogacy. Obviously those things all cost money, more money than they're anticipating. If they were to do IVF, you're going with a clinic who's going to do no stim to low stim, you know, like you do not need high stim medications. I don't care. I had one girl recently, I think she's 47. She's like high AMH, right? So anyway, we figured out a blood sugar issue with her. She's like a lean type.
Lean type PCOS.
I know I'm doing this. Anyway, but they would collect like 20 eggs in a retrieval, nothing to blastocyst, nothing. So same sex couple, I had them switch donor first. They did that. Then we started getting some more blasts. Then we dug deeper. We changed the medication protocol. They were blasting her with meds because of her high AMH. And I was like, no, you got to go low stem. Low stem, like literally cut her meds by like 75%. Yeah. The same amount of eggs retrieved, fertilization rate went up to 80%.
Oh, beautiful.
And then we really worked on blood sugar, did some special things, even added in metformin. She added that in, or her fertility doctor okayed it. That was the round. So low dose, new sperm donor, blood sugar balance, 2 euploids, and 1 low-level mosaic, and she's now pregnant. I met her 4 years into this and couldn't get a blast to test. It's crazy. So now she's older, and she just made 2 euploids. You know what I mean? And the metabolic thing I think was huge. And same thing, we were the ones who found it. I said, give me the last 4 years of like your CBC. I watched her fasting glucose just slowly go up. I watched her fasting, her A1C, same thing, slowly go up. She's got this girl could be more of a biohacker. But it was just a slow. But when she came to me, she was intermittent fasting. She was a big runner. I had her change all of that. And here we are. So I have a hard time believing that it all falls off a cliff somewhere, because I've seen it so many times where there's so many other factors that come into play. So I don't know. I know I'm skirting around, long story.
No, you know, something that you brought up, because there's a couple of couples that I'm thinking about that I wasn't be able to help them. But what I yet, and it's like they still might come back because they were fairly young. But the point was that like those couples really pushed me to become the practitioner that I am today. And I always have so much gratitude for them. And I always make sure that it's like, hey, I hope you find the help that you need. And if I'm not able to help you, that's okay. And I need you to go and get, like, I want that fire inside of you that says, I want a baby and I need to help people. I need to find people who are going to help me have a baby instead of people who are going to make me feel bad about wanting a baby at whatever age, or however many babies I've already had. Like, you've had 3, and then people go, well, why do you want the 4th one? Because I want a 4th baby. Like, let me have the 4th baby, you know? Anyways, we become different practitioners because of those cases that we weren't able to push through. And I, you know, there's a lot of gratitude for those couples who it's like that time wasn't wasted.
No, never. And I learned so much
regret or sadness or whatever that comes up.
And for me too, I can like name them if I wanted to. I won't, obviously, but like those women are all still in my life. They went through menopause with me. I supported them through all these things, and I have had the, I would say, luxury. It's going to make me emotional of expressing that to them and saying like, I still think about your case, and they don't say that back to me. They are like, Amy, you did everything you could, like with the knowledge you had, and I was okay with, I'm okay. Like, my life has turned out, you know, and it's like, that's beautiful to see. And I agree. Like, I learned so much, you know, all my cases that, you know, anyway, I always say I'm an expert in, unfortunately, I'm an expert in recurrent pregnancy loss. And that's because I had some really serious cases. And then I kind of watched, who are they working with? I would have them like record their meetings with their doctor so I could hear what they were saying. Then I just would like reach out to the doctor and be like, hey, I have some questions. And then the doctor would share things with me. And then that's how I learned, honestly. I would just pick brains. And I would sit and I would look at the protocols and try to understand it. And then, yeah, it's like, you see it. And I said this actually to one of our girls when the GLP-1 started coming out. And I was like, there's a certain doctor that a lot of us have worked with or referred to. And I was like, and he's always been the metformin, helps with mitochondrial function. I was like, you watch and see. He's going to start just talking about GLP-1s and endometriosis. And sure enough, it's like all over his social media now. Yes. Like, he is hard on it. And he's just like, this is going to change the game. And it's not about weight loss, guys. You know, it's about metabolic function. But yeah, I mean, that stuff is, it's an honor to have been around that long and to witness so much. And yeah, you know, Dr. Braverman said that to me once too. You always remember the ones you didn't help, but that's what drives you harder. And it is at totally. The end of the day, gratitude. And I trust everyone's on the path they're meant to be on, and I'm not the savior. You know, I've done my work around
yes,
that.
Yes, before. That's hard for us.
It's hard. The ego gets very involved. I mean, most of us that wind up in this field, it is that like kind of helper mentality. And so it is that thing of like, I'm going to give you all the tools. What you do with them is up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Why get into this space in the first place? And like, you're writing books and helping women.
Why did I mean, I think ego at first, to be honest. Only like, I mean, I've done enough work. I can just say that about myself, but like, how I always tell the story is, right, I'm a medical school dropout. And so I was total nerd and science nerd, and getting into Chinese medicine was like a big leap of faith, right? I had to like believe in qi and believe in this like energy medicine. And I was like, oh God, this is,
how do you spell that?
It did. Exactly. It spoke to me. But when I got out there in like the field, you know, it was like, looking at labs, when I started to see things shift based on like herbs and acupuncture and diet, I was like, damn, this is awesome. And so I always say the pregnancy girls, I got hooked because it was like, it either works or it doesn't. We either have a baby or we don't at the end. And so that kind of hooked me. But then also I think just seeing the suffering behind closed doors really motivated me, because every single woman, would come and be so worried that it wasn't going to work for them. They weren't going to have their baby. And I was like, I wanted to just scream from the rooftops of like, no, there's so much we can look at. There's so much we can do. And so, yeah, I guess I got a little hooked. I mean, when I wrote Yes, You Can Get Pregnant, that changed everything. It was like I didn't have an online business. People were reaching out to me from all over the world. It was Skype. We didn't have Zoom back then. It was Skype. You know, can you do a Skype consult? I was like, what do I charge? How do I do that? I don't know. Okay. Yeah. And that's how it all like really for me. And so, and then I just got more and more into it. And And I like to learn.
And now you're talking about vitamin J. How important it is.
Vitamin J. I love vitamin J. That's not mine. That's from Institute of Functional Medicine, one of the professors there. But I asked permission. She said yes. But yeah, joy. I mean, I've been talking about that in Chinese medicine forever, of like, joy is the antidote to fear. Joy is the antidote, you know? And so, yeah, that's a big part of our work too. And, you know, now I have a team, so that's why I said our, but like, joy on the way to baby, not joy when we get to baby, you know? And so a big part of our work is like helping our clients light back up, right? They're really broken. And it's really hard to witness. I don't know why I'm feeling so emotional. Like, when I get to see her on the other side, I always say like the same thing. I'm like, it's so nice to meet you. Like, I never knew you. I didn't know you, you know, and it's so nice to see who you are like in the world. And it's so good that you got like, and also though they're never the same, and the journey breaks them, but changes them in beautiful ways too. Right. It is this thing that's truly magnificent to watch and be a part of. And it's an absolute honor.
But I don't know about you, but I actually,
every way. Yeah.
I actually do see the woman who she needs to become, and I'm just helping her get there. And so when she gets there, I go like, I'm so glad you got here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's who I've been trying to talk to. And it's like, I just had a client, she did a case study, and like, God bless her soul when they come on the podcast, but she had a loss of 37 weeks. Oh, and so it's like, you know, when they send you a picture of that baby, you're just like, like it's waterworks, you know, it's such a beauty. Totally. And you know that she had such a healing, birth from that whole experience. So,
Those losses. I mean, every loss sucks. Those late term losses are just the worst.
Oh, oh. Yeah.
But yeah, talk I mean, it's just, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, talk to us about your book.
You Can't Get Pregnant, the revised edition, came out late March 28th, 2026. And it's Yes, You Can Get Pregnant Plus is what I would say. So I kept the bones of the original Yes, You Can Get Pregnant and just kind of filled in gaps with research and more research. I literally 10x'd my amount of citations in the book. Like my editor was like, these are going to have to live offline in a PDF because we can't fit them in the book. Tons of research. And then I have a whole new chapter on IVF. I have my 7 rules of IVF. I have a whole new chapter on improving egg and sperm quality over the age of 35. I have a whole new chapter on ovarian rejuvenation techniques. And I do that with Dr. Zahir Murhi of Rejuvenating Fertility Center. I talk about peptides in there and all the latest, you know, mitochondrial biohacking tools and all those things. And I still, again, like keep the core, like vitamin J was in there back then. It's still in there, you know, all the lab.
Insulin resistance, thyroid.
Oh, all of that. I have, you know, the chapter on overcoming fertility challenges went from, I think, 17 pages to like 55 pages or something. And my editor was like, where can we cut? I was like, we can't cut anything from this. This chapter does not get touched. Like, no. I was like, we actually, I have a bunch more interviews.
Make it sections, but it will be one chapter.
Well, that's it. Like, I have interviews of doctors that over the years that I've worked with. So I put those in the book. So I was like, I'll pull the interviews. They can live on the website that goes with the book because this content is not leaving the book. So, because to me, it's the most important piece, you know, and I really dig in. I dig into all of it, leptin, insulin, you know, circadian rhythm, nervous system, biohack, all the things, endometriosis, adenomyosis, you know, chronic endometritis, everything. But then also there's always a holistic lens. It's like, this is what it is. This is how you can test for it. This is how you can treat it. These are the natural things you can do. You know, these are the questions to ask. And so, you know, this kind of map for you to help you figure out what could be at the root and then how to get the proper testing.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you for doing God's work.
Thank you too.
I'm looking forward to connecting with you again in the near future.
Jane, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Tell everybody where they can find you. They can follow you.
Yeah, just my website has everything, amyrupp.com, and I'm pretty active on Instagram and TikTok, so you can follow me
there.
Just
how we met.
That's right. The gram. The gram, yes.
Well, thank you, Amy, so much for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
I really appreciate the work that you're doing in the fertility space. It's big.
Same.